Hi, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we have very special guest Tom McGrenery. You know, Tom's an RPG writer and translator. He's written for Feng Shui, Knight's Black Agents. He wrote the acclaimed Melandros about Brazilian swashbuckler. He's translated the Elephant and Macaw Banner, and he co-hosts the review podcast Fear of a Black Dragon. We'll be talking to Tom about a whole bunch of stuff today.
Welcome back, everyone. Tom, thank you so much for joining us. I have been a huge Fear of Black Dragon fan for quite a while, I just love listening to you. I guess for folks who don't know, haven't seen it or heard it, I should say, Tom, can maybe actually rather than me ham-fistedly talking about it, Tom, tell us about Fear of Black Dragon.
Yeah, so it's this podcast about games. No, first of all, thank you for having me. That's very kind of you with your very complimentary comments. I'm not entirely sure how deserved they are. But anyway, yeah, so Fear of a Black Dragon is, as you say, it's a review podcast about, I think the phrase we use is old school modules and setting books. And in each episode, me and co-host Jason Cordova look at a particular book, which might be like, yeah, an adventure, could be something from the actual olden days of TTRPGs or something in the OSR or NSR, you know, a new thing. And we first of all talk about what we liked about it, questions we have about it, and then we have a section after that every episode called The Expert Delve, where we look at a topic that is sometimes loosely connected to the thing we're supposedly reviewing and sometimes quite tightly. I think a lot of people think that's the best bit, actually. And then we round it off with a section called Companion Adventures, where we recommend movies or music or other media to look at or listen to, either, again, because it's instructive in some way or just because it's in the vibe of the thing we reviewed. And that's how it works. And it's produced on a schedule that I would describe as irregular, because one of the kind of selling points of it is that we always at least one of us has run or played the thing we're talking about. What that means is we can't do it very quickly. So it's something that, although having said that, we've just like recorded two in 2 weeks. So it is possible if we build up a backlog of material in the interim. But yeah, that's pretty much how it works. And you can find that wherever you find good podcasts.
Excellent. Excellent. That's, you know, I've been telling Dan for a while that we should have you or Jason on the show for a while now, because I think there's a great intersection of our interests of our audience. Dan and I like to say sometimes the secret mission of Wandering DMs is kind of bridging the gap between the old school players and the modern new school D&D.
Definitely.
And yeah. So definitely, like, we focus a lot on old school, but I mean, the fact is, right, of course we play lots of RPGs, and we often end up talking about various story games. And I think I've heard you and Jason talk in the past, and I wish I could remember what episode this appeared in, but I'm sure I've heard you two talk about this idea that the old school D&D has maybe more in common with modern story games than either one of those has in common with 5th edition and the latest editions of D&D. And it just, that really struck me. Yeah? No?
Yeah. I think we have advanced something like that theory, or the fact that the story game movement has more in common with old school gamers than they think. I'm not sure how that's a debatable statement. I would say that they have more in common
Well, let's debate it.
Yeah, but what I will say, I think what they do have in common, and what sets both kind of movements, are they movements? Let's say they are, apart from what we might term mainstream gaming, is that I sort of have this feeling, I because it has to be a feeling, because I can't prove it with objective facts, but that since, let's say, the late 90s, what we might call, the 2000s and onwards, mainstream gaming is designed it's not a very goal-oriented design process, right? Whereas story games set out to, with the aim of sometimes creating a very specific narrative shape, or just to do a specific thing, a specific kind of story. Old school games, similarly, that especially the OSR, like people deliberately looked at D&D 3, 3.5 and went, no thanks, we want something else that doesn't feel like this. So what they both have in common is they're both aiming at a very particular play experience. They're looking at, this is how we want the game to feel when we're playing it. These are the kind of outcomes we want. And we're going to design to get from where we are now to that point B. Whereas I would say mainstream games tend to be, I've licensed this IP. How can I list all the guns and vehicles in that thing in a way that I can have a series of fairly well balanced combat encounters until we get to the end of the scenario? If I was being mean to mainstream gaming, which I am. But I don't know what you guys think about that that thesis.
Well, we certainly appreciate the meanness.
I mean, I've always argued that there was a shift, right, in D&D, that the early editions, and a lot of my thought has been, you know, very crafted by influences like the old school primer written by friend of the show Matt Finch, yeah. Right? Where like the influence or the objective of these older games, the themes of them were really more about like exploration and like world building, and that as the systems advanced, right? I think there was this shift to try and maybe empower the players more or disempower the dungeon master to the point where it just became like the games become much crunchier, right? That's the one obvious symptom I can see of it, right? There's a lot more rules for the players to engage with, which makes sense from a capitalist viewpoint because there's a lot more players to sell books to, so we should probably make more books with more rules for more players. I feel like those games, the more modern games, they become much more focused on like the details of combat, right? The execution of the sequence of activities, rather than these much larger, broader views of explore a world.
Oh yeah, I think that's
consternation on Dan's face.
I think it's fair. Although I'm not entirely sure about disempowering the GM or DM, because I think a lot of very old school DMs were running things where, well, you know, if it's on the encounter table, there it is. Although they designed those encounter tables, so it's ultimately their fault. I do think you're right, and I think another thing that the increasing complexity of D&D and its ilk led to, basically, the more time you spend on creating and maintaining a character, the less likely you are to be happy about losing that character, and that could be like character death or going out of the game some other way. However, what I think that has robbed modern D&D of, because I think we all know what I'm dancing around here is there's a lot of safety nets in D&D now. It's quite hard to kill off a character, and it's often put forward in fact that you've failed in some way if that happens, I'm not a killer GM. Well, maybe I am, but I don't think like the sort of slightly sadistic killer GM thing is desirable either. But I think what all these safety nets rob us of is the ability to have the excitement of being brave. Right, I remember once running a one-on-one game. It was sort of a pickup game because we'd had some cancellations for a player who decided to play a thief. I think it wasn't a full-on old-school game. We might have been playing World of Dungeons or something. And we got to a bit where this thief's fantasy housebreaking. He was trying to steal a painting or something. I forget, from a fancy house. It had gone quite badly wrong, and he decided that his best shot to get away was just to jump off the roof and hope that the fall didn't kill him. And we kind of came to an agreement. I said, well, D4 damage, that seems pretty reasonable. And he went, yeah. And I said, how many hit points do you have? And he said, 2. And I said, I picked up the D4. I said, this is quite exciting, is it? And he went, yeah. And I got a 1. It was fine. But and that's the thing. Like, I don't, if you know that you're not going to die until it's like narratively appropriate, or you've gone through all these death saves and various other things, you don't get that. Now, maybe you do get that right at the end of the campaign when you are down to 2 hit points and, you know, a goblin with a dagger comes at you unexpectedly. But it's not a feature, really, of mainstream gaming. And so that I think is something that was lost. And you're right, also, the exploration and discovery, that it's weird. It's as if everyone just decided, yeah, no, we don't like that part of the game anymore. We're just not going to do it. Or, you know, wasn't that bit quite good? That bit seemed quite good, but we've just decided, no, I don't know how that happened. No.
Fascinating. You know, one thing that I have said a number of times, and, you know, our background is that, you know, I got started with D&D in the first edition era. I think Paul started around the second edition. We kind of both love the BX series. We both ran a lot of, you know, BX stuff. Nowadays, I tend to actually try as much as possible to run original D&D, something based on out of the box in 1974. And one thing that I say a lot is that I liked the game more when it was about stuff outside the game, when it's referencing a broader culture or broader themes that aren't entirely self-referential. And so if you dig through the core original D&D books, they don't describe the equipment. They don't describe the weapons. There's a list. They don't really describe what the monster is. It assumes that you are reading a broader selection of literature to know about the medieval culture that you're playing in, to know about the monsters. And there's also a whole lot of references to pulp fiction characters. It mentions Conan and Elric and a bunch of other things that presumably you're reading. And my take is that as the IP became more of a sellable thing, they wrung all those outside references out, and the current D&D game becomes more and more about talking about D&D. And as the more rules they write are to address things about D&D in D&D for D&D. Does that resonate with you, Tom, about liking a game that's talking about things outside itself?
Yeah, it does. And also, one of my least favorite things is self-referential D&D. Although that did set in pretty early, like, just, yeah, actually referring to spells by their spell name in character, that kind of thing. Just I hate it so much. Okay. I don't know how deliberate that was, though. I think that's sort of a thing that maybe players also a little bit did to themselves, and you can see it nowadays when sometimes you mention a term that also exists in D&D. And people are unable to, like, a warlock. That's just a common English word in the olden days for a kind of sorcerer, but now it means something specific.
Yeah.
You can see, though, this isn't exclusive to D&D, because I remember things I didn't really start with D&D. Having grown up in England in the 90s, I started with Warhammer and stuff like that. And I still have a copy of the very first edition of Warhammer 40,000, which had, by the way, a GM in it as standard. Weird. Although it was slightly before my time, but I picked up a copy later. And remarkably, that has a whole section on making your own scenery and vehicles out of household objects and toys and things. And even has a note saying, it's not really practical for us to make miniatures of vehicles, so we'll probably never do that. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with Games Workshop today. That's not an attitude that really continues to exist. So those guys definitely went the economic route of, we're going to bring all this in. You know, even like, don't refer to gaming anymore. You know, it's now the Games Workshop hobby. It's the phrase, that kind of thing. Wow. So, I don't think TSR
that's like
did it
right up there with the D&D being for up to 50 players. That's great.
That is, yeah, wow.
Yeah, and it's very parallel to early Gygax saying, "We're definitely not going to ever publish adventures." That's obviously the interesting imagination part for you DMs. We'll, you know, and he really crapped on the idea of publishing adventures at one point. And then somebody else came
at most about 6 months before actually doing it, right? We're talking about a pretty compressed timeline here between. Yeah.
Wow. Yep. Totally. Totally.
Gary.
So one of the things I love about listening to Fear of a Black Dragon, for folks who haven't listened to it, right, is that Tom is clearly very, very well-versed in the old school. But then Jason clearly has a much deeper background.
As Jason doesn't care. Listen,
is that...
Jason doesn't care about the old school.
Doesn't care about the old school, but he definitely knows his story games, right? And you know, as obviously authored a ton himself, but also has played, you know, quite a few of them. And so I really find it interesting when those things start to be juxtaposed, right? Like usually, if you listen to an episode, right, where you two give your bona fides of the module you're about to review, inevitably he's run it in some system that I have to go look up. I'm like, what? Wait, he's run it?
Yeah.
Wait, what is that? I've never played Trophy or...
To a degree, yeah. To a degree, I sort of feel like I have to be the one that's run it in the actual game it's for or something slightly more. But just so we can have that dichotomy. I think in earlier episodes, we were both sort of... And it is a kind of a feature and a common complaint, I will note, that we often like run the adventure in something else. For example, I enjoy it. There's the Space Marines in Trouble OSR game, Stay Frosty. I'm a kind of fan of that. So I like to reskin adventures so that they're about space stations instead of dungeons, that kind of thing. It's, and people don't like that sometimes. I've observed. Yeah.
It's your fault that I once ran Death Frost Doom in Stay Frosty. I was just so taken by your description of running that, and then thematically giving it that kind of Star Wars skin was just delightful. If you're going to sit down and run a classic dungeon crawl adventure, you know, classic fantasy D&D sword and sorcery kind of thing, what are you turning to? What do you want to run it in these days?
If I'm going like proper old school D&D levels and things like that, I tend to, my first thought is Blue Home, which is the sort of repackaging and expansion of the Homes D&D thing by, I've just forgotten his name, Michael Thomas, I think is his name. I know him. I personally have met him more than once. Am I not remembering his name? Which is good. It's like, because I remember when I was a kid in the sort of Warhammer Fantasy phase, I did get a copy of that Holmes edition, the one published by Games Workshop. It was sort of secondhand. And I found it very hard to understand, whereas Blue Home takes that and sort of lays it out and explains slightly more, like, so you get what's going on. And I like that. It's kind of, it's pretty old. It's old school enough to have descending armor class, that kind of thing. So that's nice.
So I think that's by Michael Thomas. That's great. Is that right?
Yeah, Michael Thomas. I think that's, yeah.
And for what it's worth, that's actually what the original Holmes game is actually what I started with. That's what I first got for D&D one Christmas after seeing it it reviewed in a magazine. And it sounded wonderful, so that's how I started. It's funny because a lot of times if I'm designing or writing something, that's one of the things I will actually have a little bit of nostalgia of, like that very first D&D adventure room that I ran. And everybody died in. It's usually where my memory takes me back.
Dan misses the little cardboard chits that it came with. I think.
You know about that, Tom? You know about that?
I've never seen a copy with the chits, because of course anytime you get a copy, the owner has already punch them all out, use them.
That is how I started playing, probably for about the first year I was pulling chits out of cups. And then the day when my mother came in and surprise gifted me with dice, I will never get over. There's no version of an iPhone that's going to ever impress me as much as those 5 polyhedral dice when she brought them in.
Yeah. Well, everyone loves dice. One of the ways people get sort of interested in role-playing games is seeing the dice and going, wow, what are these? You know, like, it's...
Right. Yeah.
They're not the dice. They're a big part of the draw, I think. Well, you can see that, like, everyone gets crazy for collectible, barely readable dice in Kickstarters or just...
I thought that I had a lot of dice at one point, and then I get on social media, and I'm like, good Lord, people, what are you doing? No. How do you find
I'm not kidding about the readability issue either. I'm a high trust GM, and the reason I'm high trust is because people say, I got a 12, and I go, yeah, I guess. So I can't tell.
Interesting. Yeah.
I'm very low trust. I got burned. I got burned with my players in the 80s. So as Paul and our viewers know, I'm extremely low trust. I'm continually trying to find ways to not trust and verify. So I totally feel that.
So I want to get back to the original thesis that I was trying to push here of old school D&D is like story games. So I'm curious, Tom, like, are there any examples you can think of, you know, or maybe original TSR modules or whatnot that you've run using some new modern story system that we can talk about?
Oh man, I'm gonna have to delve into the memory banks for this one. Hang on, let me think this through a bit. I don't know if it's still sort of a bit OSR rather than story gamey, but I did run the it doesn't really have a name, it's the sample adventure from it's the sample dungeon from the Holmes D&D set.
Yeah, some people call it the Tower of Xenopus is what a lot of folks call it.
Tower of Xenopus, yes.
Well, our friend of the show came on. He actually has a kind of elaborated product on that at one point.
But it's a great sort of starter dungeon. So yeah, I ran that using a game I had devised. So instead of it being a dungeon, well, it was still a dungeon, but it was like an alien underwater ruin in the Arctic Sea, and all the player characters were in little submersibles traveling around in that. And that did have a bunch of story gamey stuff to do with kind of going back up to the surface and having kind of relationship drama while you restock your submarine and then going back into it again. So that works. And I think, a lot of these lighter games, but they're not really story gamey. I do remember episode one of Fear of a Black Dragon. My suggestion was to run, what's it called? I should just look up episode one of Fear of a Black Dragon. What did we do? Is that one about a village that sort of you roll dice to randomly determine where the houses are and who's in them and stuff? What was that called? It's a good thing this isn't.
And we all scurry and look it up. Everyone, quick, look it up. I know. I know exactly what you're talking about. What system were you arguing to use it with?
And I was arguing to for some reason to use Paul Sager's story game about low income teenage girls and nicotine girls, which is a game that was very influential on me when I've still never played it. I remember reading it in like the early 2000s and like having, because I've been sort of having some frustration, I think in the early 2000s, a lot of people have been having some frustration with combination of D&D and Vampire the Masquerade not really being the game that it wanted to be. And so Nicotine Girls and then also Paul Sager's game, My Life with Master, where you sort of play the minions of a Dracula or Frankenstein type villain. And these were all games about, you know, love and despair and hope and whatnot. And it was just like really absolutely divorcing gaming from that paradigm of, you know, kicking in doors and having fights or everything being about success versus failure, but rather kind of moving into it. And it is as simple as just kind of changing what you're rolling dice for. Sometimes is all you need. And so Nicotine Girls is a really fun little game, or that, which I assume is a fun game. I don't know. As I say, I've never played it, but even just the idea of it was enough to send me down that kind of story games rabbit hole. And I do think a lot of village settings in old TSR games, you could just have the people that live in the village. That could be your game, and then all the kind of the nearby dungeon then sort of becomes some either a source of trouble or your season finale kind of confrontation episode. I think that would work pretty well. Yeah.
I mean, there's certainly written modules, right? Like Hamlet or L1 Bone Hill, right? Which are very focused on a town, and have little to no actual adventure content.
Yeah,
they're just like here's a town.
Yes, which is sort of a bit of a problem with Hamlet, if you ask me.
Well, sure. Yeah.
What are we doing here?
Yeah. Even Keep on the Borderlands is half. You know, half of the product is the keep. which weirdly, you know, when I first ran that as a kid, basically my one player didn't understand what the point was, frankly. So they got to the keep, kind of didn't have a broader perspective, and then just started burgling the keep is what they did. They went into the church and just tried to rob the priest, and were immediately beat down and put in the keep's dungeon. And as far as I know, since 1979, those characters are still in the dungeon, canonically, is what I've always assumed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's not a unique experience with the Keep on the Borderlands, because the module does expend quite a lot of word count on dealing with exactly that kind of behavior. So I think that presumably is what a lot of people did.
Was it Scenic Dunsmuth you were talking about earlier? Is that what we were
Scenic
trying to
Dunsmuth, get at? Thank you. Oh, my goodness. Oh. Yeah, Scenic Dunsmuth. Yeah, that was it's a weird, fun little thing. There was a character, and there was a bit of a vogue, wasn't there, for randomly, like, dice drop mapping and everything for a period in the OSR.
Nice.
Go on, Dan. No, I was going to take us in a new direction.
No, you go ahead, Paul.
We're so professional here on Wandering DMs. Okay. Right. I would argue that these modules feel like a good fit for story gaming. Again, I think because of this quality that story gaming shares with old school gaming, which is this very openness, right? This like, you know, you can do anything attitude, right? This sort of, you know, change the rules to fit what you want, you know, explore the world, inhabit the characters, et cetera, et cetera. And I feel like that's maybe the piece that the modern zeitgeist has lost. Go on.
Yeah. Please. You're looking at what, sir?
Oh, my favorite weird kind of crossover moment D&D publication is actually this book, Marvelous Magic, which, as far as I know, is the only book that was written for both Dungeons & Dragons and Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. I have it on my desk because we were just talking about it, I think, last episode or an episode or two ago. Yeah. And it actually gets in the back, in the appendix, it actually starts to talk about the difference between D&D and AD&D. And I don't know about you, Tom, but I first encountered these games as a kid, I had no idea that these were two different games. I had some AD&D books and some D&D books, and I just figured, it's the same thing, right?
I mean, yeah, more or less, what does it say the main differences are? Is it talking about from
really
a mechanical standpoint?
Right?
Or, yeah.
No, well, it's more, I think it's almost more of just an ideological one, right? So here, I'll read you a little bit. It says, the D&D game is easy to modify to your individual taste. When revised and expanded, editions published in or after 1983, some details were added, but the game as a whole was actually became easier to modify. Then I'll jump down. The AD&D game system is, as a whole, far more complex than the D&D game. Rules are given for more situations, and common situations are presented in more detail. Since the AD&D game is more complex than the D&D game, it is very difficult to modify properly. And it goes on to say,
accurate,
like, oh, you
think.
Right? So, like, surprisingly good description, I think, of the difference of that attitudinal shift between D&D being this open world and this toolkit idea versus AD&D being this, you know, I always thought of AD&D as being really tied, or not always, I recently think of AD&D as being much more tied to the tournament scene, where we have to adjudicate fairly for everyone in the same way.
Yeah, that's the thing we always forget about, the weird distorting effects of tournaments. Yeah, sorry, go.
Yeah, and I think addressing the question of cross table compatibility, I think, at the time of, I have a character in Alice's campaign, can I take it to Bob's campaign? Are there issues with that? Which, you know, of course, nowadays turns into organized play type, you know, organizations, things like that. So I think that was the tournaments get all the ink. And I think at the time they were also concerned about just being able to move between different DMs tables.
That makes sense. But sorry, to come back to the open worldiness, Paul, that's, I think, yeah, obviously there are a lot of story games that have a very particular narrative arc, and we're not really, you know, it's going from here to here. and that's how they're designed. But you're right, we all know the watchword of Apocalypse World, the first and greatest Powered by the Apocalypse game, which is play to find out what happens. And I think you're right, that's what they have in common. They sort of don't write the third act of the adventure, see what happens. And that, for me, is the great enjoyment of it. And I've advanced the theory, possibly coined a phrase, that old school games are fantasy non-fiction, which is a term that seems to make no sense, but I promise it does. Which is that I think when we are deciding what kind of story our old school game is going to be about, and I think this is a weird thing that old school gamers actually do think about kind of genre and story a bit, and they do discuss it, but they never do it directly. It's always things like what level your character's going to be. Are we using the Sundered Shields rule or not, right? Which, I mean, that is a very meta-narrative thing. What you can decide when your shield breaks, that's interesting. Because you're sort of deciding, aren't you, is this non-fiction book that happens to be set in a fantasy world, is it going to be history of, like, an ordinary Roman legionary on Julius Caesar's invasion of Gaul? Or is it going to be about Julius Caesar? Is it going to be about a literally average person? Or are they going to have more hit points so you know they're going to get to at least a lot closer to the end of the events that we're following than otherwise? And if you're writing a book of history, that's what you do as well. You decide which story out of all the things that happened you're gonna cover. And the joy often of nonfiction books, right, is that it's not always about, well, it is always about having a satisfying resolution to the story, but quite often that satisfying resolution is the tale of what could have been, right? Sometimes it's about the champions who win all the sports. They win all the sport games. But other times it's about the guy who was the next big thing and then it didn't happen for them. And what's that about? And I think old school games are like that, but for fantasy adventurers, like, some of them hit the big time and some of them goblin with a dagger, level one of the dungeon. I think that is a big part of the appeal of it. And that's why it needs to be so open in terms of design, so you can kind of make those decisions. I'm not entirely sure. Once I start saying this stuff out loud, it stops being quite as convincing as it was when it's in my head. But I don't know. I feel like there's something there.
We appreciate the intellectual honesty.
Yeah.
Good on you.
Great.
Good on you. You know, I was... Go ahead.
No, I've cut you off too many times, Dan.
So I noticed, Tom, so it was a couple of years ago, you had an episode where you and Jason picked at the time your top five OSRE adventure picks. And the top, like there wasn't any D&D adventure that got in your top five. I noticed that your top three were all either Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, or actually your top two were Call of Cthulhu, actually. And I think you were debating with your narrowly avoided picking Enemy Within, I think for like your top three somewhere around there. And that's very close to the stuff, probably more so Paul than me, very close to the stuff that Paul has run for years. He did a long running Enemy Within campaign series live play on our channel a couple years back that everybody had a lot of fun with. And he also had, for years at our house cons, Paul was running Call of Cthulhu inspired evolved games that the rest of us were calling Paul Thulu, is what we're calling it for a while. and then we finally got him the other year to publish that as a game called Fearful Ends. And I don't, you know, I don't traditionally run horror games myself, but I've actually run a session using Paul's Fearful Lens, and it worked super well. So what was it about Call of Cthulhu that took the top? Do you still agree with that? What was it about Call of Cthulhu that took your top two spots in your favorite adventure list?
I can't remember what order they were in. I'm almost certain that number one is going to have been The Secret of Castronegro, because that remains a classic. Like, it's, and it is, I think, if you know, you make it, you kind of recast that to be set in the village of Homlet, that's a scary D&D adventure. That's how it was. Because the setup is so good, right? It's a constrained little mini sandbox. Once you're dropped off by the bus in town, it doesn't come back for like 3 days or something. Classic horror setup, but also a classic adventure setup in general. And after that, you do get to just do whatever you want. There's a little bit of a timeline. Basically, if things get boring, people start shooting at you, I think. And it just has so much to recommend it in terms of it's not... How do I put this? A lot of... I mean, maybe most Call of Cthulhu adventures, horror mysteries, are very mean with the clues or the information, right? Which is okay. Not good for reasons I've gone into at length in other venues and probably isn't the topic of discussion today. But like Secret of Castronegro has it, everything is sort of not out in the open, but you just got to go and follow your instincts, and you are still solving mysteries. There are still things you can figure out, but they're not puzzles, right? There's not like a specific, here's the answer. Guess what, or as my friend Clayton used to sometimes refer to it, a guess what the GM is thinking scene, and which he was quite good at running. He would have a puzzle and then he'd go, do you guys want another 10 minutes on this, or shall we just assume you've solved it? And of course often we go, no, we want another 10 minutes because we think we can do this, but you don't want to like be stuck behind that. And so Secret of Castronegro has the classic village plus dungeon setup from something like the Reptile Cults, what's that called? Against the Cult of the Reptile God?
Exactly. Against the Cult of the Reptile God, yeah.
Yeah. Although the dungeon part, of course, is much less... It's much mm-hmm. smaller and takes up less of the adventure because it's Call of Cthulhu. But in terms of, yeah, structure and atmosphere, like, you know, you're not going to run all your old school games in 1920s New Mexico like that with the sort of the horror theme. But if you take all of that, the way it's set up and the way it evokes its atmosphere, and you take those lessons and you apply them to, let's say, slightly gritty fantasy adventuring with some magical elves in the forest and so on. I'll make the bold statement. I think it's the perfect model for a 1-2 session town plus dungeon fantasy adventure. It's that good. Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah. So I stand by that one. I don't remember what number two was, but I assume Dream that I also stand by it.
As of 2 years ago, it was Dream Factory.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. Well, that is still now. I don't think that's old school in the sense that we're like discussing OSR and stuff. So some stuff we review on the Fear of a Black Dragon is old school in the sense that it's old. Dream Factory is amazing, though. If you can get hold of it, it's incredible. So it's set in 1920s Hollywood. And again, very sandboxy in the sense that it's not location based as much as you're catching up with these different NPCs who are involved in the disappearance of a Hollywood starlet. So it is very good. I highly recommend it. But I don't think if you want an OSR adventure, don't get that. That's not what it is. But
Funny because as we tape this, our last 2 weeks, Paul and I have specifically been talking about mysteries, mystery stories, murder mysteries, and whether you can even run them in classic D&D or whether a different system would be better for that or how to set it up or things like that. So it's interesting that both of those examples are things that are kind of murder mystery type things that, you know, maybe that's a canonical example of having a system that's really dedicated to that. If that's the kind of story that you want to run.
Maybe. I don't know how mechanically dedicated a mystery is Call of Cthulhu actually is, though. Cause I mean, it's RuneQuest, but like rebadged. And, also I think, really, the big issue people always have with D&D mysteries is that, well, what if the wizard casts a spell to find stuff out? I don't know that that's such a failing. I've always thought that actually catering to or worrying too much about magic in D&D takes away part of the fun. Like, if you, especially in this day and age where we have, I don't know how many PDFs of adventures I have in my Google Drive. It's easily hundreds. Like, finishing an adventure too quickly, not really a problem anymore. Like it used to be, you'd have to go to the store and buy another book if you finished too quick. That's not an issue anymore. And I think, you know, let's say you have let's make a really basic challenge in a game, so it's not to do with murder mysteries. But like, let's say you've got to get up a cliff, and in theory, you're going to have an exciting cliff climbing challenge that's going to be really difficult and fun. And then the wizard goes, actually, I can just make us all fly up there. I would say it's one kind of cool to you know, through ingenuity and physical strength to climb a big cliff. It's also very cool to have superpowers and just fly. And like solving a mystery by using magic, that's fine, isn't it? And I don't really see the problem with sometimes that happening. Now, of course, what you would have to do if you want to have these mysteries in a magical setting is you want to have more than one. Like if your whole game session is based on that one thing, there would be a problem if it's over in 10 minutes. But like, you know, if you're actual magic detectives, you've probably got more than one case happening. And the other thing is, I think what you notice in, or what occurs to me in both Dream Factory and Secret Castro Negro, it's not a murder, it's a disappearance. And I think a disappearance gives you a lot more to play with in terms of, you can't just ask the dead body who did it, right? Because there's no dead body.
I feel like in 2 minutes, Tom has hit all of my points so that you can just skip our previous episode and just listen to those 2 minutes of Tom talking.
No, I'm sorry.
Exactly. Yes, sir. You got it. You nailed it.
But the viewers should still watch those episodes for my
point. Oh, yeah. The viewers should still watch it. Yeah.
Very compelling. Also like and subscribe. Very compelling.
But I think, like, I can tie this back, right? So I feel like, you know, I totally agree with you, right? That the magic, you know, it doesn't really hurt the mystery part of it, because for me, the fun is not so much just solve the mystery, right? If the whole adventure is just figure out what happened and then we're done, that isn't as exciting as like, okay, you figured out who did it. Now what? What are you going to do about that?
Yeah.
Right? And I think that goes right back to what you were talking about before with Apocalypse World, right? Of like, we play to find out, right? That we're, you know, we have this open-ended, like, okay, you know, just solving the mystery isn't gonna, we're not just gonna like roll credits and it's over. You know, now we have a problem. Now we know who the bad guy is. I guess we better do something about that.
Yeah. You might have this sort of Columbo type suspect who's gone earlier on, well, I'd like to see you prove it, detective, and that kind of thing. So I think it's always an issue if solving the mystery is your end goal. Well, no, wait, hang on, let me restart this thought. I think the key is always that the outcome has to be interesting whether or not you solve the mystery. Yes. So like, you know, in real life, of course, if a murder goes unsolved for years, nothing happens, right? And although, you know, again, nonfiction books have been written about that can be interesting in itself.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes you've got to solve a mystery within a certain time period or something terrible is going to happen. And if they don't do it, then you move on to the terrible thing happening and the story continues that way. Or the classic thing of, like, you do figure it out, but not in time. Like, so, we've solved the mystery, but they've already caught a train to Budapest. Let's get after them. Or you do, like you say, you solve it, and then what do? You've got to... can you prove it? Like, I magically talked to this dead body and it told me who did it. Doesn't stand up in a lot of courts of law, I think. Even in D&D Land. So you, you're right. It doesn't, solving the mystery doesn't solve the problem. And we're all about problem solving in the OSR, aren't we? Apparently. So that's, I think you're right. That it's not just the, do you know who did it? Yes, no. That's not the actual end of the adventure, is it?
Paul and I run some games as co-DMs, like the two of us are DMing side by side. And I kind of want to see, at this point, I kind of want to see Tom and Paul run a game as co-DMs, because it is uncanny. It is uncanny. Your opinions and your observations are so much like Paul says from week to week.
Well, I mean,
it's really amazing. Yeah.
Feels like it would be redundant, but okay.
Well, that's of course, Dan, why I invited Tom to join us today, so that we could gang up on you.
That's dawning on me at this point in the episode. Thank you for calling that out.
Oh, delightful. All right, so let's explore the other direction. Because when I proposed this theory to you, Tom, of like old school is super like story games, you definitely raised an eyebrow. How are they different? Like, where does my theory fall down?
Well, I would say it does fall down with those very targeted story games where the narrative structure is what's the design goal. So if you, well, let's use a relatively similar to mainstream game, a Monster of the Week, right? It's a PBTA game that's inspired by things like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Supernatural. And it has a very planned out, this is what's going to happen, structure to every, what's the term for this? Each scenario, basically, there's a problem, you show up, you find evidence of the monster, you talk to people about it, you do your research, you have a fight with some minions, maybe more kind of finding out the weakness of the monster, then you have a final confrontation, and it has that fixed arc every single time, which sounds like it might be boring and repetitive, but I think in practice this kind of game, if you play it as more than once, a lot of the time it's designed to only be done once anyway, but of course as the characters change each time they encounter this cycle, and that's where it sort of gets interesting, is that they're the ones that make the difference. Even though the cycle is the same, the details and the way that the players and the player characters react to them can be different each time. That, I would say, is completely... Like, obviously, you can do it. You could run a D&D game where that's the... or an old-school D&D game where that is how you're doing it. But I don't think anyone would go, yeah, that's old-school gaming. It doesn't have that expansive, we can do anything feeling. And that's not a bad thing, because the game is designed to be that way. And also, hopefully, everyone's agreed that that's what the game you're going to play. So it's, we're going to do this particular structure. And I mean, there is some compatibility in that you can kind of use the materials from one game style in the other. But I think that's where they really diverge, is that you, for all the number of play-to-find-out games there are where the design is based on exploring the genre or a certain feel, there are other games that are all about a particular format, you could say, or a genre exploration.
I'll buy that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I you know, because as we were talking about this, you know, when a personal favorite of mine is Fiasco. We had Jason Morningstar on here talking about Fiasco a bit, and immediately my brain was starting to think of, like, okay, well, could I do it? Could I run like the Caves of Chaos as a Fiasco adventure?
No.
And I'm like, maybe.
I mean, you could, in the sense that I think you would basically have to, I mean, okay, in practical terms, it would be difficult, but essentially, you know, if everyone's got the book in front of them, you know, the dungeon map, and so everyone is like, that's just open, it would be your setting, I guess. But could you run it in the sense of we're exploring a dungeon? Like, not that way. I don't think you could. It'd be fun, though. I've often thought about doing things like Monster Hearts as a dungeon crawling game, because I think that would be pretty hilarious. But
yeah, I think we were talking about that, I think, in one of our after chats with our patrons the other week, of there is a legitimate difference between does the referee actually have secrets? Are there actual concrete secrets that you either find out or not, as opposed to the players inventing the secrets on the fly? A difference between, did that happen? The DM might say, no, that wasn't what happened.
Yeah, I think that's where I was trying to go with like comparing that to like Monster of the Week, which I've not played Monster of the Week, but the way you're describing it, Tom, you know, it sounds to me like the format, right? We all know we have an expected outcome of the overall format, but is Monster of the Week, is there a DM? Are there secrets that the DM has written down and the players are trying to figure out?
Yeah, there is. There's a DM, the MC, I think, as it's called in that. Who cares? It's the DM, whatever. And yeah, they have like a, if I recall this correctly, the structure is always, it has sort of stats and characteristics for the monster, but it also has daytime, twilight, sunset, then midnight. And that's the sort of escalating danger levels. And of course, it's like a front in apocalypse world. It sort of advances as you go along. So the race is always to gather the most resources and info before you get to the point where you have to confront it. Like, you're always going to have to confront it at some point. But it still has, and the GM is in charge of knowing all that stuff, and parceling it out.
Yeah. I feel like that. See, that strikes me as similar in, say, Fiasco, where you have structured acts, right? And you're doing structured scenes. So there's a pacing that is set by the game itself, right? By the mechanics of the game. Unlike an OSR game, where in theory we have all the time in the world to explore the caves of chaos, right? It might take one session, it might take 10 sessions, who knows? And we might see the entirety of it, or we might not, right? And we might, all die in the first room, or we might miss a whole section because we didn't find a secret door, and that's fine.
Should we talk about
very different. Yeah.
Should we talk about some stuff that Tom has done recently, perhaps?
Which we definitely kind of should. I'm chewing time here. Let's talk about Tom's work. Please do.
So Tom, we were talking a little bit before the show started about something you wanted to talk about.
Oh yeah. So one of the things I do in my guise of the brand name Porcupine Publishing, because people sometimes ask, like, why do you publish stuff under a brand name even though you're just like one guy? And the reason is because sometimes we publish things by other people, and it becomes confusing if you've put your own name on the thing. So, and in this case, one of my ongoing projects is I translate the Brazilian role-playing game The Elephant and McCaw Banner, which is based on a series of novellas, which are available in English, which is sort of, he likes to describe it, Chris Kasten-Schmidt, the author, as like a Brazilian The Witcher. So these two kind of companions in arms in 16th century Brazil travel around from town to town, encountering strange and new cultures, like the Spanish, but also people like the Tupi or whatever. And there's always a monster or threat in town, a bit like Monster of the Week, actually. And then they sort of, deal with it. And the role-playing game is also set in Brazil, but it's the Brazil of legend, where all the myths and things are real things, like the flying flaming skulls that are secretly usually a rich person that lives in town just haunting people by night. One of my favorites, actually, there's a lot of head-related things. So there's the headless mule, the Mula Sem Cabeça, which is a mule that's a woman that turns into a headless mule that gallops around the parishes by night, gouting flame from her neck stump. And like, if you encounter this thing, it'll probably kill you. All kinds of weird and wonderful monsters like that. But it's also very historical, and it was developed in part with the Brazilian, co-sponsored by the Brazilian Education Ministry. So there's lots of high schools around Brazil that have this game in the classroom. There's a whole bit in the back about using role-playing games as classroom materials. So there's the main book, and there's a bunch of adventures for it. And so I translate those in English with reasonably well, I think. And the most recent one that I published maybe last week, actually, is called The Serpent Mother of the World. And this is part two of what's going to be a 5-part campaign. I think they're reasonably standalone, because this one starts with, you're going up the river to find out what's up with the weird rumors of... do the players already know about the Rogue Templar Knights? They might do. Anyway, there's some Rogue Templars in the Amazon. You've got to go up the Amazon River. And it's a tough journey. And yeah, it's kind of what you might expect. It's a little bit linear because it's on a river, I'll be honest with you there. But you have all these... what I always enjoy about these adventures is they're very exploratory. You're kind of encountering these civilizations and cultures that you, the player, probably don't know anything about. Your characters definitely don't. And so you'll have things like meeting. There's a bit with a kind of embalmed mummy that's the shaman of a town that you visit, and you have to kind of figure out how to deal with that mummy's spokespeople, the shamans. Also, there's some combat stuff. You do find a Spanish fortress. There's a little bit of historical political stuff here, which is that the Portuguese are not supposed to be in this part of South America. It's Spanish territory. So like, when you show up at the fort to try and get supplies, you got to there's this whole slightly tense, you're welcomed in to have dinner, but then they're like, so what are you doing here? And let's have this whole conversation in Spanish, and let's see if we can take our way through that. And that's a nice little bit. And then, you can see on the cover depicted there, you do things like encountering the spirit of the water lily, who asks you to help her stop a demon from trapping the moon in a magical pool of water. And if you fail in that, the moon will disappear from the sky. So it goes right between these sort of nuts and bolts, right, trading for rice and fruit, to bizarrely huge cosmic stuff, which sounds like it wouldn't really work, but it does. You sort of, part of, I think, the fun I've had with playing these adventures is that there is this idea that when you're on the frontier, and of course there are there's a lot of issues with how much of a frontier this is, and who's you know, taking slaves and colonizing things, and that, and the game does sort of well, it addresses that in various levels. That's part of what's in the appendix about using this in the classroom, because of course different age levels or wanting to grapple with these issues, you know, you accommodate them. But like any time when you are at least like personally in a place you've never experienced before, there's always the sense that anything could happen, to a degree, right? And in the Elephant and McCaw banner, anything often does happen. And yeah, it's a really fun game and worth checking out. It's not a sort of OSRE system itself. It's sort of a D6s based thing, and it's kept quite simple again, so it can be used by kind of kids of around 12 plus, I would say. But of course, the material, the adventures are quite OSRE. There's this one, Serpent Mother is good for that. And I was going to try and do a recommendation for, like, I think it's best just to go browse the catalogue and see which one catches your fancy. There's a really interesting one called Sisters of the Nightbird, which was done by a different writer. And it's set in the same period, but it's set in the West African kingdom of Oyo, which is this like really fascinating. So it's like half source book about living in the capital of that empire. And then the back end is a scenario about a curse that's come on the king, and you've got to go investigate these scary witches that live on a mountain nearby. That's pretty cool as well.
Yeah. I think that sounds very interesting. And I think that one of the blurbs I saw, that game was originally in Portuguese, right? Yes.
That's right, yeah. Although the author is an American, so that's why the novels are in English. The game's in Portuguese because it was very popular in Brazil.
Fascinating.
But he doesn't translate it himself because, like, there is this... I guess he just doesn't have time. But also, I think there's a thing where translating your own work is maybe not desirable for various reasons, you know. So that's why... But yeah, like, it's originally in Portuguese, which causes me no end of trouble when I get to things... Names of animals between languages is not, it's very rarely a one-to-one match. And every time there's a new animal that shows up, it causes me a real problem with how to translate it into English. But
I hear that. I think it's very interesting that, I mean, one of the blurbs I saw for the game is to be set at the end of the imperial era of Brazil, of 16th century, which to me kind of feels Renaissance-y. And I think
that's Melandros, right. The end of the empire. Actually, this is kind of the opposite, and it's interesting for that reason as well. Like, it's the very beginning of, it's not even officially, like, there is no Brazil. This is a colony of Portugal, and in part, and parts of it aren't controlled by Portugal and so on. And there's lots of stuff in the books, which I try and leave in, but slightly rephrased, which it's addressing a Brazilian audience and saying, like, this is the beginning of what we know today as blah, blah, blah. And like, it'll be the location of some gigantic city in modern Brazil, but right now it's sort of two huts and a jetty on a lake or something. And it's interesting in that respect. Yeah.
It's really interesting they have that, like, actually as a goal to have it in schools, because of course, when I started playing, and we didn't use the term at the time, but nowadays people refer to it as the Satanic Panic. It was wildly inappropriate. Like, having D&D in a school was wildly inappropriate at one point. And for what it's worth, when I talked to my mother, who worked a long time as a nurse in a school system, she is to this day, you know, pleasantly amazed that D&D or other role-playing games are allowed in schools. Like, oh, the school has a D&D club. Can you imagine that? And, you know, for me, where I started out, it is a jarring transition that's happened, actually. So to hear educators, and I, you know, frequently say that one of the great values of D&D or the role-playing games, learning about everything. Frankly, just learning about absolutely everything is one of the great values. So it's nice that we, there is a positive thing in the world these days, and that someone has recognized that somewhere is wonderful.
Yeah, I agree.
Amazing.
I'd love to spend more time digging into this, but unfortunately, we are just about out of time. So I have to ask at this point, any final thoughts on, on the elephant macaw or translating works or OSR versus story games?
I'll give that to Tom. If there's anything Tom wanted to get in the show that we overlooked, please tell us.
Oh, man, I don't think so. I think, because basically any final thoughts added at this point would turn into another like 20 to 30 minute discussion of more things. So it's probably safest to round it off like this. Yeah.
Yes.
I completely agree. We could do a whole nother show easily. Easily. Well, viewers, we will place for you links to where you can find Tom's work in the show notes here. You can look for that in the description of the YouTube video that has been uploaded, as well as on our website. If you have any thoughts, questions, you have a violent reaction to my crazy theory about old school games and story games, please leave us a comment here in the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe that'll spin off a new topic for us for a future show.
Definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, places like that. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all the sites. So please look for us there and transfigure that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those files are available on our website at wanderingdms.com and also through various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and all those other places. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those other sites and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And every single tier gets you, among other things, access to our Discord server with the conversations continuing around the clock about old school games and new school games and miniatures and war games and horror games and all kinds of stuff that we love. And we just have the best, smartest patrons. And we will love to see you there joining in the conversations. So, Tom, hopefully you had a good time today. And we know that we could all keep talking for a while. Hopefully we can get you back at some point, maybe.
Yeah, well, that would be, I'm sure we can find something else to bang on about for a long time. No, it's been really fun. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It's been a privilege.
Awesome. Thank you so much for making time today. So, of course, we have a pretty regular schedule here at Wandering DMs. We're live almost every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please, we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.